Frisch serviert, der Steuerpodcast.
Hello again, hello everybody. This is Frisch serviert or Freshly served, because we're having a English-speaking edition today again, and we are welcoming a special guest from the US. Our special guest is Pat Brown, the National Tax Office co-leader of PwC in Washington, D.C., the United States of America. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Christian. Great to be with you guys again.
Yeah, pleasure to have you with us. And actually, both of us and the other half of us, that's Arne Schnittke. Hi, Arne.
Hi, Christian.
We had the pleasure of meeting with you, actually, coincidentally, in the same week. That's 2 weeks ago, right? We were sitting on the USCIB conference with wonderful topics, especially 899. We'll talk about that later. And then in the very same week, Arne was hitting Washington, D.C. Himself, right, Arne?
That's true. That's really coincidence. Did you see everything is happening in Washington, even more nowadays, you know?
Well, and it was, by the way, it was the hottest week in probably a couple of years in Washington. So you guys managed to come there when the weather was really, we really rolled out the red carpet for our visitors by making it as unpleasant as possible.
for sure.
I thought it's the 899, Section 899 fever. I was thinking, but actually it was really, really hot. It was really bad.
Yes.
So we are talking, or we want to talk about, Pat, the one big, beautiful bill. Act. The act comes across a little bit weird because it's a bill, right? So, yes. But this OBBBA, there are two components in this one. There is the, it's actually all pleasant by now, almost, right? There is the history component, that's 899, and maybe we start with the history component. Section 899 that was proposed for the Internal Revenue Code. I believe everybody of our audience knows about Section 899. We had a special edition on this one. So we don't have to go into depths there, but maybe Pat, you give us your 5 cents on where it was coming from and how it all ended, and then we see where we are.
Yeah. So Section 899, of course, was the Congress's, in particular, Republicans in the House of Representatives, going back a couple of years. And I'm not, to your point, Christian, I'm not going to re-go through all of the history here, but. Going back a couple of years, really reacting very strongly to this notion that Pillar 2 in particular was an affront to U.S. tax sovereignty, that it was sort of taking away the ability of the U.S. Congress to write rules with respect to issues like credits and incentives, the U.S. R&D credit, things like that. It was in the House bill, the bill that passed the House of Representatives initially. After it passed the House, there was a lot of blowback, particularly with respect to the potential reaction from the investor community. So a lot of, you know, concerns about things like, will this affect the market for U.S. treasuries or other corporate bonds or things like that? And the Senate came back with a revised version of Section 899, which maybe you'd call a kinder, gentler version of Section 899, but it was still really going to, you know, it still had a lot of teeth. It was still going to hurt a lot of companies with significant investments in the United States. It was clear, I will say, as the bill was moving forward towards ultimately what became passage in the Senate, that both the U.S. Treasury Department, Secretary Bessent, and other senior officials in Treasury, as well as senior folks in the Senate, were getting a lot of pressure from inbound investors that Section 899 was potentially going to be quite disruptive to investing in the United States. So there were concerns about that, but the parties appeared that the Treasury Department and the Senate appeared to be holding firm. Section 899 is going to stay in the bill. It's going to stay in the bill. Meanwhile, behind the scenes, there were some very serious negotiations going on with the other members of the G7 at a finance minister level. So this is Secretary Bessent and his counterparts, to try and hash out some sort of a framework deal that would potentially allow Section 899 to be pulled from the Senate version of the bill. And ultimately, that's what's happened. So very shortly before the Senate took their version of the bill to the Senate floor for ultimate passage, Secretary Bessent announced there's been an agreement reached with my counterparts at the G7. And as a result of that, there's, you know, essentially acknowledgement that the U.S. international tax system will coexist side by side with Pillar 2. And in return for agreeing that, for other countries agreeing that, we will remove Section 899 from the bill. Now, very shortly after that, Secretary Bessent announced that agreement, the two chairmen of the tax writing committees in the Congress, so Chairman Smith, who chairs the House Ways and Means Committee, and Chairman Crapo, who chairs the Finance Committee, they released a joint statement. This is not a typical action, to be sure. They released a joint statement essentially saying, we are very happy to see this agreement that Secretary Bessent has announced. We think this is important. We think it's, you know, it's very a very good agreement for the United States to achieve. But to be sure, we are watching. And we will, you know, if the other parties to this agreement drag their feet or don't kind of follow through on what they have promised, we stand ready to take action. Now, they don't mention Section 899 specifically coming back, but they're clearly, you know, intimating or suggesting with that statement that Section 899 is kind of being pulled out of the bill and put to the side. But hey, we're still the chairman of the tax writing committees, and we will take action if we need to protect U.S. interests. So that's where we are right now on Section 899 and, you know, the Pillar 2 framework.
Right. And just for my information, the Section 891 discussion, which has been coming a little bit calm over the next weeks and months, theoretically, it would be still on the table, even though I haven't heard any concrete measures or anything right. alike. But these are two, just to remind us again, these are two independent kind of developments, even though in practice it is kind of indicating 891 should be also off the table. So what's your
Section 891, and again, just remind folks that is a provision that is already in the Internal Revenue Code. It's been in the Internal Revenue Code since the 1930s. It is not active because it is activated as a result of the president. This requires action by the president proclaiming that a country has adopted extraterritorial or discriminatory taxation measures that call for essentially a doubling of tax that would apply on investors from those countries. It is a very blunt instrument. Again, it's in the code today. It's not active today. You're right, Arna. It's still there. It's potentially a stick that could be used by the president, by the administration. Of course, Section 891 raised a lot of questions. We talked on these in the prior podcast about how would it interact with U.S. tax treaty obligations, given that Section 891 really predates all of our bilateral tax treaties. So there are a lot of questions about kind of whether or not Section 891 could be applied in the face of treaty obligations. Section 899 would have allowed the U.S. government to sidestep a lot of those issues because Section 899 would have been a newly enacted law. But you're right, 891 is still there, and it is still something. It's one of the tools that remains in the U.S. government's toolkit to respond to if they believe that what actually emerges from this G7 agreement is not sufficiently, you know, in the interest of the United States, I guess.
Well, we from a European perspective, I believe we are all happy that 899 is gone.
Right.
But the storyline, and that's sort of surprising, the storyline before was we, the US, we always told the OECD, actually, we is a very difficult word in that regard, that we don't like this and that Congress and Senate never approved. That's actually right. Precise. And that we believe this is extraterritorial and la, la, la. Right. And we have guilty, so we already delivered in that regard. Why should our U.S. headquartered businesses have to apply both two sets of rules?
Right.
It's an administrative hassle. It's not so much an additional tax burden, it's administrative hassle. Scott Bessent then came after the G7 agreement and said, well, with this agreement, U.S. headquartered businesses are going to save $100 billion over the next couple of years, not being extremely precise on how many years. But that's a number, I would say, not for U.S. standard. Maybe it's a small number, but from a European perspective, it's actually, compared to your overall debt, that's pretty much nothing. That came as a surprise. And then in addition, it looks a little bit out of balance because a U.S. headquartered M&E with a holding in Europe, Ireland, Luxembourg, doesn't have to apply under the G7 agreement the income inclusion rule to subsidiaries of that Irish Luxembourg holding.
Right.
In the other case, a European headquartered business with a U.S. holding, and that can happen very fast if you acquire a U.S. target group, This European headquartered business would have to apply both.
Yes.
The income inclusion rule at the ultimate parent entity, plus then the GILTI in the US for right. the non-US subs being held by the US yes. holding company. So it's actually it's sort of out of balance.
Yeah, it's a great point, Christian, and I want to respond to both of the things you raised. I think taking the second one first. So the G7 agreement is specific with reference to U.S. headquartered companies not having to apply the Pillar 2 UTPR or the Pillar 2 IIR as a result of essentially the U.S. GILTI framework applying to the foreign subsidiaries of a U.S. multinational and, of course, U.S. domestic law applying at the U.S. level. But you're exactly right. The G7 agreement is silent with respect to the question of, well, if you're a non-U.S. multinational that has a U.S. subsidiary and then has some non-U.S. subsidiaries underneath it, if the topco has adopted an IIR, which, of course, in many, certainly across much of Europe, you would have, the topco jurisdiction has adopted an IIR, everything that sits under the U.S. would be subject to both the Pillar 2 IIR and the GILTI framework. And that is exactly, to your point, what Treasury has been saying should not be happening. Right. They basically say the U.S. international rules are sufficient. They're not the same as the Pillar 2 rules, but they're sufficiently robust to prevent base erosion. And therefore, companies should not be required to apply both. But the G7 agreement, at least by its terms, only references U.S. parented groups. And so for these non-U.S. parented groups, well, there is a sort of imbalance here. And I think that maybe is one of the questions that remains to be worked out. It is worth noting that the G7 agreement is really an agreement to agree. It's about a page in length, not a lot of detail there. That's not a criticism. It's just a reality that this is the way these things take shape, particularly at a sort of finance minister level. So there's a lot of detail that has to be spelled out underneath that. But this is, to be sure, I want to call it an imperfection, a discontinuity remains to be worked out. With respect to your first point, which is Secretary Bessent coming out and saying, you know, as a result of this agreement, we're going to save, you know, U.S. multinationals will save hundreds of billions of dollars. I don't know what's behind that. Candidly, in terms of where that number came from, I do know that for a lot of U.S. headquartered companies, a consistent refrain, this is, by the way, going to sound very familiar to both of you as well as to the listeners of this podcast, is the real cost of Pillar 2 was not the increase in taxation, it was the increase in compliance costs. And the number of companies, both U.S. and non-U.S., that we've all heard from, who have said, essentially, I will pay a small fraction in additional Pillar 2 tax compared to the compliance costs that I will face. This is one of the things that I think Pillar 2 has really struggled with almost out of the gate. Almost immediately is just the level of complexity associated with it. And in that regard, Christian, it is worth noting, maybe this is one of these kind of second bounce of the ball questions in the context of the G7 agreement, that one of the points in the G7 agreement is, and I'm obviously loosely paraphrasing here, a real call to deliver meaningful simplification for Pillar 2. So that is not obviously something that's limited to U.S. headquartered groups. In fact, it would apply more to non-U.S. headquartered groups than U.S. headquartered groups, given the nature of the agreement. So there's a lot to think about here. But I don't know where that number came from, whether he was referring to the compliance costs or something else. And, you know, the fact that he's looking across potentially the entire universe of U.S. companies subject to Pillar 2, you know, there could be any number of ways that number could have been derived. And I'm just not familiar with them.
Mm-hmm. And perhaps I think the compliance costs, I can certainly say from a European or German perspective, that's what we're hearing all the time for,
yeah.
I think, the right reasons. Just to be clear, even with this agreement, which we're seeing right now, the compliance is not gone. And also Pillar 2 for U.S. multinationals is not gone. We're still having two DMTTs, right? So how is the discussion around that? I mean, I guess everyone is kind of relieved, basically. We don't have to apply, obviously, IIR. I mean, that was never a discussion point that you guys going to alter your rules, but we're not going to see any kind of UTPRs in German, right. Or Sekundärergänzungssteuer, just to throw in a German UTPR translation. So that's really which is off the table, but everything else is still on. And how do people see that? And also, what's your what's your guess? How will the OECD basically, you know, follow up? You said there is the expectation of further simplification measures, maybe, yeah. But there's also now the question, do these QDMTs have to show some teeth right now? I don't know. Where do
yeah.
we see?
Yeah. So I think this is one of the most fascinating developments. If we kind of rewind the tape back to the very beginning of Pillar 2 and just go back to when the model rules were released in, when was it, December of 2021, I think. You all will recall very well, I'm sure our listeners will as well, QDMTTs were basically an afterthought. They were hardly mentioned in the model rules. The concept was there, but it wasn't spelled out at all in any detail in the model rules. And obviously, we got subsequent administrative guidance that has spelled out the concept of QDMTTs more and more. But to your point, Arna, QDMTTs now really are, I would argue, the most important element of the Pillar 2 framework. Because, to your point, U.S. companies will still have to comply with QDMTTs in all jurisdictions that have adopted them. And it will be vitally important from the perspective of the OECD inclusive framework in maintaining sort of the, I'll call it the integrity of Pillar 2, in maintaining Pillar 2 at all, that QDMTTs remain in place, right? Because for U.S. companies, QDMTTs are what will remain of Pillar 2, what they will have to do. In order to kind of make sure you have this kind of competitive balance between U.S. companies and their non-U.S., you know, competition, the non-U.S. competitors, the role of the QDMTT is critically important. Also a point that was referenced in the G7 agreement. So this, again, this QDMTT was sort of the kind of redheaded stepchild, if you'll forgive the, you know, English expression, when the model rules were first released. Well, now it is like the kind of the sort of cornerstone of the entire exercise is QDMTTs. But to your point, Arnett, now you have this really interesting question as well, which is, okay, how has this agreement with the US potentially changed the incentives for countries that have adopted QDMTTs? How is the OECD thinking about that? One of the other things that the OECD, or excuse me, that the G7 mentioned in this very brief G7 agreement was, hey, we need to revisit this question of incentives. And, you know, the question of incentives has always been, in some respects, I would say, one of the Achilles heels of Pillar 2, this whole distinction between refundable credits being good, getting favorable treatment versus all other credits, and how that created a lot of friction, particularly with some developing countries who don't have the same flexibility to offer refundable credits. They just don't have the financial wherewithal to offer refundable credits. And so that's always been a point of friction. Now you see this re-emerging in the context of the OECD really very strongly wanting to make sure that countries that have adopted QDMTTs keep those QDMTTs. Well, how does that desire on the part of the OECD for countries to keep their QDMTTs interact with countries wanting to offer tax incentives, maybe having more of an incentive to offer tax incentives to U.S. multinationals who aren't going to be subject to the Pillar 2 IIR and the Pillar 2 UTPR. Well, if you want countries to keep their QDMTTs, do you want to maybe offer more flexibility around incentives so that countries essentially have more flexibility for both U.S. and non-U.S. investors to offer tax incentives that are a bit more flexible? I have no idea how this is going to play out, right? None of us do. But it's going to be one of the things that I think is going to be really interesting to watch, how the OECD approaches this question, because we know there's been pressure on this building up for a while. Maybe some people would have thought, well, if you create a special deal for the United States, you no longer have the United States pounding at the table around things like the US R&D credit. But I actually think the deal that we've now reached with the United States probably creates more pressure on this question of incentives. Because again, because of the desire on the part of the OECD to make sure that these QDMTTs stay in place as a robust, as really the most significant part of Pillar 2. How it all plays out, we'll all watch and learn together. I have no idea, right?
Actually, Pat, I believe nobody has any clue how many of those elements of the agreement will be achieved. Looking at the EU, I wonder, I mean, that's really a surprise for those folks. And last week, there were some statements that actually that can all be done via interpreting the directive, the European Union's minimum tax directive. I don't know. It's actually I tend to interpret a lot of things, but I have a tough time in finding the right hook there. So that is I would say that's stretching the limits of the written word a lot.
Yeah.
But we'll see. It will stay and be exciting for quite a while.
Yeah.
Maybe we should move to the other part of the OBBBA,
yes.
Which is the making permanent of all those nice benefits that the TCJA in 2018 introduced, right? So maybe yes. And who could give a better overview than you, right? So maybe you give us a quick overview of what has been made permanent there.
Yeah. So first of all, let's put the individual stuff to the side, even though the individual stuff is really what drove the bill forward. But there were going to be some individual tax increases that were going to take effect starting in January of 2026. That was really the action forcing event for Congress to do this legislation. But to your point, Christian, the TCJA, the 2017 tax legislation, so this was really the first reconciliation bill that President Trump signed in his first term in office, introduced three distinct new foundational elements to the U.S. international tax framework, right? There was the GILTI regime, the FDII regime, and the BEAT regime. And GILTI, of course, I'm sure everyone is familiar, our version of a minimum tax that applies to foreign subsidiaries of U.S. companies, not the same as Pillar 2, but introduced in 2017. FDII, I mean, a lot of people compare it to a patent box. It offers a preferential rate on essentially what was intended to be originally intangible income. So income from royalties or income from manufacturing and selling products only related to foreign markets. So it does not apply in the United States. That's a key difference from a typical patent box regime. It does not apply within the U.S. market. That's the FDII regime that was introduced. And GILTI and FDII have always been seen by members of Congress as sort of, you know, operating in tandem. So, you know, a lot of times members will talk about GILTI and FDII as sort of making it neutral whether you invest in the United States or outside the United States, because roughly the same rate applies to both income, whether you're applying it through the GILTI regime and you're taxed at what will now be a 14% rate, or the FDII regime within the United States, where it will be taxed at a 14% rate. The BEAT, look, we could spend an entire podcast talking about how strange the BEAT is and how oddly the BEAT operates. The BEAT is a version of a minimum tax. We have a lot of minimum taxes in the United States. The BEAT is yet another version of a minimum tax that was introduced in 2017. It never really made a lot of sense in a lot of fact patterns when the BEAT applies. Unfortunately, that remains the case after this bill. So I'll start with the BEAT. The one thing that was done in this bill to the BEAT was to raise the BEAT rate for non-financial companies from 10% to 10.5%. So a pretty modest increase in the BEAT rate, but that's not a taxpayer favorable change, obviously. There were some other changes that were scheduled to happen next year with respect to the BEAT that would have made it even more onerous, particularly relating to the computation of credits in your BEAT computation. Again, I'm not going to go into the details on that, but Congress essentially said, hey, we're not going to let those unfavorable changes take place. We're going to essentially keep current law on a permanent basis, but we're going to raise the rate from 10 to 10.5%. Otherwise, everything that people have come to hate about the BEAT remains the same. So that's the BEAT, probably the easiest thing to kind of talk about. If I turn next to GILTI, which is probably the one that most folks would have the greatest familiarity with. So the broad contours of GILTI remain the same, right? Still computed on a so-called worldwide basis, so global blending, to use the Pillar 2 terminology. Congress did increase the rate. So the rate increases from 10.5% up to, well, I'm going to call it 12.6%, with an additional increase in the rate because you're not permitted under the GILTI regime to take a full foreign tax credit for your foreign taxes paid. So the effective rate on your GILTI earnings if you're a U.S. company is somewhere between 12.6% and 14%. That's the way GILTI operates. The big benefit that taxpayers got from this OBBA in the guilty context is the elimination of the apportionment of expenses in your guilty computation. Again, the level of detail well beyond what we have time for today. But essentially, the requirement to apportion expenses resulted in a lot of companies that were paying very high foreign taxes on their guilty income still paying U.S. tax because of the impact of expense apportionment. That has been taken away. So that was a significant positive. And the last change that was done with GILTI, and here again, we can draw a direct parallel to Pillar 2. Pillar 2, of course, has this concept of the substance-based income exclusion, right? The SBIE. GILTI had a similar concept. We call it the QBI regime, right? Qualified Business Asset Investment, I think was what it stood for. Congress stripped that out. So now GILTI applies to your first dollar of foreign earnings, effectively, without this benefit of an SBIE type system. So that is a taxpayer unfavorable change. So we take those three things together. The rate on GILTI went up, not all the way to 15, but closer to 15. We pulled out the U.S. equivalent of the SBIE, but we got rid of expense apportionment. Otherwise, we maintained the system. And then the last thing I'll just cover very quickly, the FDII regime. We notched up the rate on FDII. That's a taxpayer unfavorable change, up to 14%. Note 14% matches the GILTI. And the other thing that we did in the FDII context is we eliminated the FDII equivalent of the SBIE or the QBI concept. Now, interestingly enough, in the FDII context, that's a taxpayer favorable change. FDII applies now to your first dollar of earnings without having to haircut it for the equivalent of this SBIE. So if we look at all three of the big international, I hate to say pillars, foundational elements from TCJA, that's what happened. So the beat, not a lot was done, but the rate went up. GILTI looks more like Pillar 2 in some respects, still with global blending. And FDII, the rate went up a little bit, but we provided a benefit in the form of stripping out this QBI concept or SBIE concept in FDII.
Very interesting. And they are applicable from which year on, and also how likely this is going to go through from your kind of overall view? 27, I guess, no? So from which year on?
Thanks, Arne. I didn't hear the question. Everything I just described takes effect in 2026.
2026 already. Okay,
yeah.
Got it, yeah.
Yeah, so at the end of this year.
Yeah, and likelihood,
this is coming up fast.
And likelihood of going through, because this is still going through the normal kind of process, I understand.
Well, look, at this stage, this is law. President Trump signed the bill.
Okay.
So what has to happen now, which is going to be really important, particularly around things like the apportionment of expenses, Treasury has to write regulations.
Right.
Those regulations are going to have to fill out a lot of the details around this. But I would say that what we have seen now come out of the Congress is going to broadly be the framework for the U.S. international tax rules for the indefinite future. The big change here, from the perspective of many companies, many investors in the United States as well, is: are we going to have FDII? Is it going to be at 13.125 or 16.4 or where? Because all of these rates were scheduled to change next year. They were all scheduled to go up next year. So Congress has essentially said, we want to get out of this business with respect to these elements of having this uncertainty. So let's lock in what the rates are. They all went up a little bit, but let's lock that in and do it on a permanent basis. So now companies looking to make planning decisions have a greater degree of certainty. Nothing's ever forever in the tax law. We all know that. But at least there's not something in the code today that's a scheduled change that companies have to be worried about.
Very interesting. So a lot of things actually have been changing. Also behind the discussion, basically, what we are just following up from a European perspective. As we're going to the end of the whole of the podcast, I'm looking to a question, Pat, to you, but also Christian, to you, because we haven't really talked about the European view of this whole development, going back to the first kind of, fact that we're now basically having U.S. multinationals not having to apply the IIR. Or basically facing more the UTPR, basically, that's probably more,
right.
more correctly put. So my question is basically towards you, Christian, what do you think from a European perspective? What's your view around that? And second question, maybe they're tied together. Are we going to see some pressure, basically, that Pillar 2 rules will survive? Or will we see some discussions to what extent this has to be abolished now that this one stone has been taken out of the whole equation. I don't know. Maybe Pat, you can start before Christian as he finalizes.
So I certainly welcome Christian's thoughts on this. But I think, look, this is obviously the single thing that the OECD and the real champions of Pillar 2 in the inclusive framework have been most concerned about is if we reach an accommodation with the United States that doesn't require U.S. companies to apply the Pillar 2, the same Pillar 2 framework that everyone else applies, does that so destabilize the system that ultimately it's just a matter of time before the pressure becomes too great for it to be maintained? To me, at least, this is why the whole question we were talking about before, Arne, around QDMTTs is just so vital, right? Are they going to be in, or will they remain in place? To what extent will countries start to, you know, that have adopted them, start to backtrack on them? I think that's going to be a really important thing to watch. I also think if I were advising non-US multinationals with respect to how to approach this, I would certainly be putting a heavy emphasis on, hey, the compliance hasn't gotten any easier for us just because you've accommodated the United States here. There's a huge amount of compliance here for very little revenue. Ultimately, whether it's over the short term, the medium term, or the long term, that will not be sustainable. If you cannot address that issue, this will not be a sustainable framework. That's the way I approach it. But obviously, Christian, you have your thoughts as well, I'm sure.
Well, first of all, Arne said nothing lasts forever. And that's not true because our podcast, actually, not the individual sequence, yeah, but we are closing in on 100, right? I think
we are. Yes, we're very soon. We have 100th birthday. Yeah.
And we will not stop before 10,000 or so.
I think we're going to be the next 50 years here still.
You know, there you go. We're not going away, and there's always a lot of ammunition in tech, so we are not going out of business with the podcast, at least not there. Going out of business, Popular 2 is a different story. It's on the edge. It's really on the edge. And it feels a little bit like Stockholm syndrome. I have to admit that when 899 was taken out of the bill, I felt a brief moment of sadness because I was so busy with the topic for so long, and then all of a sudden it disappeared. It was actually what we wanted, but there it was gone, and it felt sad. With Pillar 2, I'm not sure if I will share the same sadness if it's disappearing. The difficult task will be to find a continuation of Pillar 2, which is administratively much easier, but still in line with what the OECD initially wanted to achieve. Because at the end, nobody can be interested in the OECD failing on that project. That can't be the outcome. On the other hand, we need to have something that at least comes close to a level playing field globally. So there need to be a massive simplification. And I tell you one thing, that massive simplification, I'm pretty convinced that this is not achievable on the working level. There needs to be a political breakthrough, right? Like the G7. So the finance ministers, they have to sit together and say, you know what? It needs to be much, much, much simpler. And then they have to steer their people extremely closely to achieve that. Because if you now have the people that had been designing the Pillar 2 rules work out simplifications, then this is never going to fly. Never, right? And that will be the ultimate challenge. And if that is not achievable, then over the next 3 years, the whole thing will collapse. There, I'm pretty convinced.
Okay, so what's the time frame again?
Over the next 3 years.
3 years, okay. I thought it was 1 to 2. We'll see. We'll see what happens.
Well, I gave myself one additional year, yeah, because otherwise I know you will come back in 1.5 years and say, Christian, you said in 18 months it will be all gone. But yeah. In 3 years, nobody remembers.
Okay, well, that's good. Well, thank you so much, Pat. As always, Pat, the time flies, I can see. We have a little bit taken a bit more than we usually take, but that's for good reasons, I would say. And I have a feeling that we might have you as a guest again, because I feel this is not the end of the story so far. So I would say to be continued. And thank you so much for joining again on the podcast. Really helpful, awful topic, but awesome, I want to say. Awesome, basically. And yeah, really looking forward to have you back hopefully soon.
Delighted to be with you both. Thanks for letting me join.
Thank you.
Bye. Take care.
Frisch serviert, der Steuerpodcast, powered by CH Beck.